it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind, it may be an understatement to say 2018 has been a rough year for Facebook. The company has been accused of aggressive tactics that push competitors out of the market. It faces growing concerns over user privacy and personal data. And governments have raised questions about Facebook's effect on democracy itself. One of the journalists who's helped pull back the veil on the inner workings of the social media giant is Cecilia Kong. She covers technology and regulatory policy for the New York Times. She joined me in the studio. Cecilia, as we come to the end of the year, this has not been a good one for Facebook. Most recently, from a batch of emails released in Britain, what did we learn from them?
Those are fascinating emails that were released from the UK Parliament that showed that there was, among the top layer of Facebook, the top executives, a plan to share the data of users with third-party apps without getting permission from these users. And they did it in a way that was kind of clever, is a generous way to say it, maybe sneaky as well, in that Facebook repeatedly says that it does not sell the data of its users. But what it did was it bargained for other things with other apps. And so they can actually, by definition, say technically they didn't sell data, but the effect is just as bad. And they also, these emails revealed that the top leaders, especially Mark Zuckerberg, the founder and CEO, use the power of Facebook and its dominance in social media and as a social network to bully other competitors and make it difficult for them to compete against Facebook.
How so? How did they do that?
So one thing that they did, and a good example, is Twitter. Twitter around 2012, 2013 was looking like a pretty hot company. And when Twitter introduced a company called Vine, or bought a company called Vine, which is a video application that it bought that shows very short videos on the Twitter platform, Facebook found out about it, and they used, when they found that out, they decided to cut Twitter off from this sort of flow of data that they're giving to these third-party apps of Facebook's user data. So they were basically starving Twitter from getting this valuable data that other apps were getting in exchange. It's part of this whole system of exchanging user data. In the end, it's good for a user not to have their data go to Twitter without their knowledge, but still it showed how Facebook used its dominance to prevent other companies from getting more powerful.
And all this seems in such contrast to the way that Facebook began with posting baby pictures and family albums and that kind of thing. How big a problem does this new image of Facebook become?
It's a huge problem for Facebook. It's also a huge problem for all of us, in that now there is a company that is unprecedented in its global reach. It has 2.2 billion users. It is a platform that is, in some countries, actually a utility. Places like India and Myanmar, people use Facebook to communicate and get information. That is their front door to the internet. And it's a huge problem in that the company has neglected its security obligations, its privacy obligations, and in many ways, it is very much trying to catch up and patch these holes. It was not forthright to the public in how its business model was run and how it was sharing data with other companies, and was making data so easy to pick up. And it was so easy for the platform to become abused by foreign entities like Russia. So it's a huge global problem. And the company is right now, I don't actually think that the leaders did any of this out of intentionally, meaning that they didn't look for Russians to manipulate the election and interfere on their website. They just weren't looking. They were looking for growth and they were looking for profits. And so now it's a huge problem.
You and your colleagues at the New York Times managed to peel back these layers of secrecy that Facebook had been operating under.
It took a lot of work. It was about a 6-month investigation, and we started with one animating question. What was happening inside Facebook in 3 years of crisis after crisis after scandal after scandal? And what was happening at the very top ranks and the decision making that was done? So, Diane, it just took persistence. It was hard. It's not easy. And the second part of our story was to look at once things started to become very difficult for the company, it turned on a new strategy to squash the criticism of people from the outside. And they started a new game, if you will, of lobbying in Washington. And we wanted to show what was happening inside and what they were doing outside.
So you say that the top figures in the Facebook conglomerate were not deliberately opening the way for Russia or any other entity to use their data to manipulate the U.S. election. But those people at the top were, for example, trying to squash the image of George Soros.
Yes.
Why?
The company, and I think this goes to the culture and of the company and the style of its leaders, they are very resistant to criticism from the outside. And so when George Soros at Davos, actually this year in January of 2018, gave a speech at the World Economic Forum, and he criticized Facebook and Google for being very powerful monopolies that were not in the best interest of society. And immediately what happened was Sheryl Sandberg, who is the chief operating officer of Facebook, asked her lieutenants, why is he saying this? I want you to start investigating. Is he trying to short the stock? Is there a financial gain from this? That spooled into a whole process of hiring an outside firm known as Definers, based in Washington and in Silicon Valley, to start researching what Soros was doing, but then also planting stories and planting information about Soros.
Negative stories, negative information.
That's right. And the reason why this was actually a huge problem and very controversial is there's this whole brewing and stewing sort of portrait of George Soros as a financier who is Jewish, he's a survivor of the Holocaust, and who is trying to influence thought around the world. And that's become sort of a bully whip for many conservatives, particularly the far right and white supremacists. So it's a real bogeyman to try to go after George Soros in that way. And so what began as a curiosity really spiraled into something that was, when revealed, showed a side of Facebook that many people did not realize, that they very much go on the offensive against critics.
And the side of Sheryl Sandberg.
That is right. I think one thing that we tried to show was how the leadership of Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, present themselves in a way it's a very orchestrated and carefully tailored image for both of them. They both have their own images very carefully tailored. Under that, there is a style of resistance to criticism, deflecting and defensiveness when something is pointed in their way, delaying, really not addressing the biggest problems in front of them, really focused on growth and revenue. And in many cases, minimizing the disclosure to the public how bad the problems were in Facebook. That's what we discovered after 6 months, is that there was a pattern repeatedly when it came to the Russian penetration of Facebook to manipulate the U.S. election in 2016, when it came to the spread of disinformation, when it came to problems globally with the Myanmar military spreading disinformation that led to the killing of many Rohingya Muslims. Pattern after pattern, episode after episode, that showed that the company was not focused on the great vulnerabilities of its site. And one can say that Sheryl Sandberg is receiving a lot of heat. Some people say unfairly, but she is ultimately responsible at Facebook for everything that relates to policy, regulation, communications, marketing, the business itself. Mark Zuckerberg is only in charge of technology and building the products for technology. Sheryl Sandberg's in charge of everything else.
Give me, if you can, a specific understanding of how Facebook might have affected the fate of the Rohingya population.
Well, one thing that happened was there were reports from within Facebook, their staff, that that the Myanmar, and we have written about this. My colleague Paul Mosier in China went to Myanmar and talked to military officials who were spreading disinformation.
Through Facebook?
Through Facebook. And in Myanmar, people rely heavily on Facebook and Facebook's apps, such as WhatsApp. That's one of the apps that Facebook owns. It's a messaging app. And the Myanmar military was spreading disinformation about how the Rohingya Muslims were threatening and that they were a problem and they were leading to dangers for the greater population. This led to a lot of division within the company and within the country, and ultimately can be attributed to how many of these Muslims were attacked and murdered. This is not new, Diane. Using, as you know, communications platforms, radio, TV, there's a history of this, to spread propaganda. In this case, it was lies that were spread. The problem, and going back to your question on where this lands with Facebook, Facebook had only a handful, at the most, of people who even spoke Burmese and spoke the languages that were permitted, so they to even detect what was happening, the content on their site, that it was dangerous and hateful and disinformation. And Facebook now does say, it concedes, that it did not put the resources there. Many human rights groups have pushed for Facebook to close down the site in Myanmar, until the company is able to resolve their issues or at least have enough resources to detect the problems and to squash the problems. Facebook did not do that. So that is a problem. That's one of many problems globally.
And now a quick break. When we return, more of my conversation with Cecilia Kang of The New York Times. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Cecilia Kang. She covers technology and tech policy for The New York Times. Where does all this leave Sheryl Sandberg, who became so outspoken and focused upon through her book, Lean In?
Yes. I think Sheryl Sandberg is in a very difficult position in that she herself put herself out there in the world, not just in the U.S., as a leader, not just as a business leader, but as a thought leader on women's issues and gender parity in the workplace and in leadership. And she formed an organization called Lean In that's funded in large part by her philanthropy. But it's a global organization, and she's seen as an iconic figure for as a successful woman in leadership, in business leadership. She had political aspirations. She very much was interested in a different role. She wasn't going to be at Facebook forever. So it's a difficult position. Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg have to figure this out. They've got to solve this. They've thrown tons of resources into hiring people to address things like I just discussed, this Rohingya Muslim crisis and the genocide that's happening there, and getting more resources and people monitoring content, investing in AI and other technologies to detect hate speech and disinformation, boosting security. So they're trying. They're very late to the game. So what happens with Sheryl Sandberg depends very much on how they emerge from this. I think their biggest test is actually 2020, the next U.S. presidential election, where we may see a repeat of what happened in 2016 when thousands of ads were bought by Russian government-linked agencies to spread disinformation. These are the kinds of things that she has to look for. One thing that I want to mention, too, is Sandberg is in a very tight spot because she is the number two at Facebook, very powerful position, but the company is 100% Mark Zuckerberg's company. And what I mean by that is he is the owner of the vast majority of voting stock. He is the chairman of the board as well as the CEO. Very much everybody really responds to one boss, and that is Mark Zuckerberg. Yeah. So ultimately, Sheryl Sandberg has tremendous responsibility there and tremendous power over many divisions there. But really, the buck stops with Mark Zuckerberg.
So in all of this, what's been Mark Zuckerberg's worst mistake?
I believe Mark Zuckerberg's worst mistake is separating himself from the realities of having and operating a global platform with enormous social, democratic, cultural implications. There's no company that I can think of that sits more squarely at the intersection of technology, politics, culture, society, so many different things. And he was focused on technology and finding the next cool thing and building the next interesting thing. He did this purposely. So it's the structure of the company. So he was not hearing many times the worst of it. He did hear some of the worst of it too. And at that point, he relied too much on deputies like Sheryl Sandberg and her deputies who were not making it the first priority. They were, when they heard at first from the head of security, his name is Alex Stamos, that there were problems that they were detecting on the site with Russian-backed accounts that seemed suspicious. The inclination of the top leaders were to delay a response, to minimize the importance of it, to tell Stamos and his team, don't disclose that much. Just say the bare minimum. Yeah. They omitted the word Russia from a very important security paper that was released in early 2017. Those were the kinds of actions that do not show the kind of seriousness of the broader non-technology and non-business issues that confront Facebook.
But Cecilia, are we seeing users leave Facebook?
I think the next earnings report will be a real sign of what the future will be for Facebook. The thing about Facebook, though, Diane, is that it has two wildly popular other apps, Instagram and WhatsApp. So the users that leave Facebook, and Facebook has seen a slowdown in its user growth, and it's seen in many ways a plateau of the number of new users it gets. These other apps are still very, very strong, WhatsApp and Instagram. But the number that we'll really want to see is engagement. And what I mean by that is we may or may not see the number of users decline, the number of people who actually delete the app, but we may see many people who have the app and who have an account just not use it much anymore.
Using it.
So that, I think, is a figure to see, to look for.
So what about morale inside the company where employees are still making good salaries, enjoying great benefits?
So what I'm hearing is it's terrible, Diane. The morale is really, really low because they have been the center of so much negative attention over the last couple years by the media, but also by government officials who are pointing to Facebook for many missteps when it comes to foreign interference in the election and disinformation and their very poor record of moderating content online and allowing hate speech to thrive on the site. So they're getting it from all corners, the criticism. And within the company, there's a feeling of being under siege, and there's a loss of confidence in their leadership. There are many people who are very defensive. They feel like they're being unfairly targeted. But one thing that I've heard, my colleagues and I have heard over the last 2 or 3 weeks since our story was published, is that the top leadership has pointed a finger toward the press and the media for unfairly, what they believe is unfairly targeting them, wanting to win journalism awards through coverage of what's happening at Facebook. There are many people who have reached out to us who've said this is really the wrong response that they should be having. They should not be attacking the press. In fact, when the leadership attacks the New York Times and other publications, they sound like another leader in Washington. And they are struck by the fact that the top leadership doesn't realize how they're coming across internally when they blame the press. There's a hunt for leakers within the organization. Mark Zuckerberg said that if they find people who leak information to the media, those people would be fired. Again, many parallels to what's happening in Washington.
Exactly. So you've got people on Capitol Hill who are also criticizing Facebook.
Yes. There is criticism broadly. It's not a partisan sort of feeling. Democrats and Republicans in the Senate Intel Committee, in the Judiciary Committee, in the Commerce Committee, all these committees that directly affect the Senate and House, directly affect the companies, are looking at Facebook's repeated missteps, apologies. There's a pattern that they recognize. Facebook gets caught with doing something. The top leadership apologizes. They try to solve the problem in some way. And then they repeat. It's sort of a rinse, wash, and repeat pattern. And that's been very frustrating. This is now a government that is looking at this pattern and also looking at the growing influence of other big tech companies and saying, there need to be some changes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as though everything has grown so quickly, so rapidly, without controls that need to be there. So do you think that the government could or will take action?
I think there's an inevitability that there will be regulations coming and there will be changes in legislation coming. But when that happens, Diane, is the real question. You've been watching Congress as closely as I have. Even with the change in the House leadership and the flip to a Democratic majority, there is still a Senate that is run by Republicans. This is a divided Congress still. There is broad consensus that there needs to be at least some regulation on privacy. For example, internet privacy. Europe has a privacy law that's almost a year now. Since it's been enacted, California has passed a privacy law that will be enacted in early 2020. The federal government is far behind, and the companies see what's happening in California, and they see other states trying to come up with strong privacy laws, and they're now actually asking Congress and the White House and the administration broadly to enact some sort of privacy law. They want a weak law, though, Diane. They want a weaker law than Europe, and they want a law that especially prevents broad liability in class action lawsuits, and they want a law that prevents states from coming up with their own laws. So there are many motivations for why the companies want a privacy law on the federal level.
So lots to be decided yet as to how this is all going to unfold.
Absolutely. Absolutely. 2019 will be a very determinative year. You're going to hear a lot of talk about regulating the companies on privacy, on content moderation, going after companies for antitrust violations. Potentially, there's going to be a lot of talk. But how that materializes into actual action will be, it's really hard to predict right now. In 2019, it feels like a very ambitious target within 1 year for these lawmakers to actually enact anything that's meaningful and lasting.
Cecilia, thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
That's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Yurev-Livker and Cliff Gallagher. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.